All right, good evening, everyone, both here in person and on Zoom. Can you guys hear me in the room? Okay, good. I'll try to speak loud and clear. It's a big room and there's a lot of echo. So for those of you on Zoom, thanks for joining us as well. Please just chat into your Zoom and make sure you can hear us if you can't. So welcome.
Bob Lloyd with AGP Video, hear you loud and clear.
Thank you, Bob.
Great, thank you. So thank you all for coming to this public meeting today on the draft Vineyard Order. My name is Brenna Sullivan. I'm an engineering geologist here with the North Coast Water Board, and I'm going to let my colleagues real quick introduce themselves.
Chris Watt, groundwater specialist with the Regional Water Board.
Ben Zabinski, water resource control engineer with the North Coast Water Board.
Do you hear me?
Can you hear me now? My name is Ben Zabinski, and I'm an engineer with the Water Board as well.
Great. So just a few housekeeping items before we get started. There are some agendas at the back of the room, but they basically are going to hold the contents what we're going to go over in the next couple slides. If you need the restroom, it's in the lobby to the left, and we're planning on doing a bit of a break after my presentation and before we get to public input. Okay, we'll wait for the slides to come up there. Okay, so I have some slides for you. My presentation is going to last around 50 minutes, and we're hoping to kind of give you some context today on the draft Vineyard Order, a little bit of background on it, how we got to where we are, give a little bit of context for the revisions we've developed, give you some timeline and schedule of where we are in our process, and then talk about the process we took to develop the revisions to the draft order, and then finally explain what those revisions are. So after the presentation, we'll have a quick break, like I said, 10, 15 minutes to use the restroom, and then there will be an opportunity for public input, both for the people here in person and for those of you who are joining us on Zoom. So during public input, we just ask that you keep your input to 3 minutes, at least at the start. It looks like we're going to have some more time to accommodate additional questions or discussions at the end. During my presentation, if you don't mind just holding your questions until public input and asking them then, the presentation might cover your question, and we also kind of want to get through the presentation and to be able to accommodate all who wish to speak. I also wanted to say that we're all going to be around after the meeting, so if you didn't get your specific question answered or you wanted to talk to us about anything that you heard today, we'll be around to answer further questions. We're also going to have our contact information on a slide at the end of the presentation, so please feel free to reach out to us after this meeting if you have any other questions or concerns about what you hear tonight. This meeting is being recorded. And so a link to that recording, along with these presentation slides, are going to be put up on our North Coast Vineyards website. So if you just search North Coast Water Board Vineyards into Google, you should be able to bring up that website. And again, the meeting recording and the presentation slides will be up on there. And also, you can sign up for our listserv, which we use to notify folks about upcoming events and things happening regarding this project. Okay, so here's our agenda and what we hope to cover. And just to give a bit of background, it was a year ago today that, not today, but a year ago in June that we released the draft order to the public. So since then, we went through a period of public comment where we received written comments. We had a board workshop where we got public input there. We got direction from our board members, and we embarked on an engagement plan to understand the comments that we received and develop revisions to the draft order. So the point of the meeting today is to present some of those intended revisions to you and hear your input before we finalize them this summer. So at the outset of the meeting, we're going to spend some time refamiliarizing you with the draft order, and then we're going to talk about the revisions. Then we'll take a break and have give you an opportunity to provide input. So again, here are our main objective for the meeting is just to share what we've been up to, share the intended revisions with you, and give you a chance to provide us input before those revisions are finalized. And we want to contextualize those revisions just with some background, frequently asked questions. You know, we've met with a fair number of you. I see a lot of familiar faces in the room, and we've received a lot of the same questions, both about, you know, our draft order, about the process, about the who, what, when, where, and why. And so we're hoping to answer some of those questions as well today. Okay, so a little bit about us before we get started. The regional water boards are part of the State Water Resources Control Board, and that's the state agency that's charged with protecting water quality. And our regulatory jurisdiction is waters of the state, which includes surface water and groundwater. We designate beneficial uses of water, and then we protect those through prohibitions, waivers, waste discharge requirements, policies, action plans, and monitoring and assessment. So the draft vineyard order is general waste discharge requirements, but also it incorporates policies such as the non-point source policy and the temperature policy. So because we're going to be referencing some of those, I just wanted to kind of outline who we are and the tools that we use to regulate water quality. And the outline in blue is our region. It extends from northern Marin County all the way up to the Oregon border. Okay. So again, we wanted to go just through a few frequently asked questions and just provide some framework and baseline about the draft vineyard order, what it is, why it's needed, and why we're doing it now, and also kind of get to some of the other frequently asked questions we hear about sediment impacts from other sources and how kind of outline the intent of the draft order and what is not the intent of the draft order. So I have three slides that will attempt to answer these first questions here. So we're going to start with what the draft order is. So here's, sorry, I'll wait for the slide to come up. There it is. So here's what an enrollee may have to do under the vineyard order. And I'm sorry, the orange slides for those here in the room, they're a little bit hard to read. But basically, a grower would enroll in the order. There would be a requirement to implement, improve, maintain on-farm practices, and the practices in the order are related to sediment erosion control, streamside area, appurtenant agricultural road networks, and nutrient management. Then there's, you know, water quality monitoring, reporting, and adaptive management feedback loop that will show whether or not the implemented practices are actually working. So that's kind of the base framework of what the draft order, how the draft order approaches protecting water quality. So the next couple slides are going to talk about why regulate vineyards and why are we doing it now. So vineyards are part of, you know, they're considered part of the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. That was a program that the state established around 20 years ago, and we can talk a little bit about that timeline and process. So we have about 65,000 acres of vines in primarily in the Navarro and Russian River watersheds. And in those watersheds, we have sediment and temperature impairments, and we also have decline of salmonid species. We have agricultural activities in those watersheds that could pose a potential threat to water quality, and they can also affect things like loss of riparian shade. And so that's kind of the backdrop. We also have these policy factors that I'll talk about, including the statewide irrigated lands precedents and some of our policies. So we wanted to give you a bit of background on where we got to where we are right now, on how we got to where we are right now and when that started. So California's the Agriculture Exemption from Clean Water Act provisions expired in the early 2000s. And so the regional boards, particularly the Central Coast and Central Valley, began developing waivers for agricultural discharges around the early 2000s. Then the non-point source policy was adopted. And what that did was it directed regional boards to regulate non-point source discharges, such as agriculture. So around 2010, this region formed our irrigated lands program, and we convened a series of stakeholder advisory groups. And what those were looking at specifically was how this region was to approach the non-point source regulation of agriculture. And, you know, we have a lot of agricultural diversity in our region. Down here, we have a lot of vineyards in Sonoma and Mendocino counties, obviously, but we also have lily bulb farming up, you know, in the far north in Del Norte County. We have Tule Lake agriculture. And so, you know, the geographic and commodity, you know, the diversity, if you will, in both commodity and geography really led to the decision in 2012 to develop separate regulations by commodity and by geography. And so the vineyard and orchard order was prioritized as kind of, you know, the regional board's number one focus for developing agricultural regulations in 2014. And then that scope was further narrowed to vineyards in 2018. Kind of the other backdrop to note is that, you know, most of the other regions in the state have adopted irrigated lands orders. You know, they've had them for at least 10 years. You know, the Central Coast and Central Valley adopted theirs back in 2012. And Region 2, which is the San Francisco Bay region, adopted their vineyard order back in 2017. So we're a bit late to the game in terms of kind of the statewide perspective. The other thing to note is the adoption of the statewide irrigated lands precedents that we have to incorporate into our order. That got adopted in 2019. So continuing on, in 2022, we formed a technical advisory group that was to inform elements of our draft order. We finished drafting it and we released it to the public last June. We had a public comment period and a public workshop that ended in August. And then over the winter, we met with interested parties and we embarked kind of on this public engagement plan to understand the comments, contextualize them, and really help develop revisions to the draft order. So that included vineyard tours, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and meeting with interested parties. So here we are. Right now, we've developed revisions, and we are right in the kind of beginning part of finalizing those revisions, which is why we're talking with you today. And so we're planning on bringing those back to our board in late 2024 for a hearing for them to consider adoption. Okay, so just a couple other frequently asked questions that we wanted to cover. So one that we hear a lot is kind of this question about, you know, without a Russian River TMDL that identifies and allocates pollutant loads, how can we have a regulation that measures objectives, and how do we know that vineyards are a problem? So kind of the first part of that question, how can we have a regulation without a TMDL? We have the non-point source policy that directs us, and we're 20 years late in doing that for this vineyard order. But the broader question relating to how we know that vineyards discharge sediments to our watersheds, shouldn't scroll down. Okay. Is that we have findings in our sediment implementation policy that say that exposed soil is susceptible to erosion. And then we also have the Navarro River TMDL, and that identified vineyards as one source of excess sediment due to exposed soil, rainfall-driven erosion, and drainage networks. But it's really important to note that this order does not identify vineyards as the only source of sediment, and it does not make the enrollees in that order responsible for all the sediment discharge to our watersheds. We also want to note that, you know, we recognize that most vineyard owners are already voluntarily implementing management practices through voluntary programs. Those are sustainability programs, such as the California Code of Sustainable Wine Growing. There's fish-friendly farming, there's SIP, there's Lodi rules, and so all those programs are very active in our region, and most growers are voluntarily enrolled in those and already implementing practices. So what this order does is it just requires the implementation of management practices, and then there's a monitoring program to demonstrate effectiveness at its core as it relates to sediment. But there's another question that we hear about, what about the other sources of sediment? You know, there's questions about, you know, reservoir operations, we have rural roads in our watersheds, we have a myriad of other land uses. And so, you know, we administer a variety of programs, regulatory programs for sediment discharge on other land uses. We have a cannabis program, we have a dairy order, we've had various timber orders for a number of years. We have waiver and an order for roads, and we have municipal stormwater permits. As for reservoir operations, let me bring up the next slide and we can talk a little bit about that. So here's a map of Mendocino and Sonoma County, and basically what it's showing, it's hard to see, but this is an overlay of vineyard density and some of the tributaries that are coho and winter steelhead habitats. And the main stem kind of runs through the middle there, if you're familiar with the geography of the region. And so it's really important for us to note that, you know, the Russian River's hydrology has been altered. And as a result of reservoir operations, which, you know, have turbidity inputs into the system, there's also been incision and bank erosion contributing sediment into the main stem. And then additionally, the landscape in the Russian River watershed is varied. It's a mixed-use landscape, and there are many different sources of sediment. So it's really important for us to note that the order does not propose sediment monitoring in the main stem Russian River. And enrollees in this order are not responsible for monitoring sediment in the main stem, and they're not responsible for all the sediment in the main stem. What the order is concerned with, though, is the tributaries in the Russian River watersheds, which are sensitive habitats to species of concern. And some of these tributaries also have a high density of vineyard land use. And so the vineyards are responsible for monitoring the sediment just coming off their own property if they have ag drainage structures. And that is only to drive the improvement of management practices on their own property. The representative monitoring that's currently still proposed in the draft order is just focused on those sensitive, you know, those overlays between sensitive habitat in the tributaries and catchments that have high density of vineyard as their land use. Okay, and then this is the final we'll frequently ask question. So we get a lot of questions a lot about why this order isn't modeled closer to the one in Region 2. The quick answer is that that permit was a program designed to implement the sediment TMDLs for Sonoma Creek and Napa River. But we have some intended revisions that would make our order more consistent with the sediment erosion control requirements in Region 2. The next question, though, highlights a pretty important difference between our two regions. The Region 2 permit was adopted prior to the statewide precedential requirements being adopted by the State Board. And so we have to incorporate those precedents into our order as they relate to groundwater and nitrogen reporting. And we can talk about that in the next slide here. So, yeah, the East San Joaquin order is where the statewide precedents came from, and it's a geographically based order. And so but the State Board took some of those requirements from the order, specifically related to groundwater monitoring and nitrogen reporting practices, and applied those statewide. They basically told the regional boards, include these in your orders as you're developing them, or revise your orders within 5 years to include these requirements. And so, you know, there could be misconceptions. We've heard that the draft order was modeled on some of the Central Valley orders, but it's just these requirements that we have to include in our order. They relate to, you know, particularly the groundwater trend monitoring and the drinking water well testing is an important, you know, the state has identified those as kind of important human right to water components. And so they direct irrigated lands orders to include those. But some of the other requirements, there's a bit of discretion that regional boards have in how they apply those. And so we'll talk about some of the revisions related to those, because we did apply, We reviewed the discretionary lens with which we have to apply these, and we can explain kind of how we revised some of these requirements here, particularly related to the last two boxes, to nitrogen application and groundwater protection. Okay, so we wanted to give you an update on what we've been up to since you last heard from us in August at our public workshop. We got over 250 comment letters, both on the draft vineyard order and the draft environmental impact report. So that was a lot of content to understand, to contextualize. And so we went out on a fairly robust public outreach campaign to contextualize comments and develop these intended revisions. So we met with growers. We were out on over 40 vineyard tours. We met one-on-one with people, with people who were interested in the process, with people who had submitted written comments. We also met with industry environmental groups, and then we conducted some outreach to help us facilitate these vineyard tours. We also went out kind of on a broad scale, landscape scale helicopter tour with the goal to review viticultural practices during the winter and make landscape scale observations. So we kind of wanted to share some of those pictures with you and share what we learned just from a landscape scale. It's kind of hard to see in this slide in this room, but this was taken in the Laguna, and you're seeing here that the bank of this creek here is overtopped and is flooded into the surrounding vineyards. So what you're seeing there are floodwaters in the vineyards. That was pretty typical of what we saw in this area. You can't necessarily see it in this the slide, but you know, the water is fairly sediment laden that came from the creek overtopping its banks there with flood water. This is a typical view looking west of Santa Rosa, and kind of the thing that we really wanted to point out with this view is just to point out the mixed use landscape. So you have, it's a mixed use matrix. You have vineyards, you have residential homes, you know, back behind the helicopter, kind of to the back of us, you would be able to see the city of Santa Rosa. So definitely in some parts of our region, there's very much a matrix of different uses on the landscape between agriculture and residential and urban. And then in some areas of the region, such as Alexander Valley here, vineyards dominate particular areas. So here we have the foothills, foothills above Alexander Valley, and you can see there's vineyards, and then there's kind of wildlands behind the vineyards upslope. Here's another example of the matrix of vineyards on the landscape from the Ukiah Valley. So you can see the Russian River kind of cutting through the middle of the screen here, with agriculture on kind of the bottom side of the screen and other land uses contiguous to the Russian River kind of immediately above it. So you have the city of Ukiah, and you can see some other land uses there. So again, that just points out, you know, how vineyards exist within these landscapes and the different inputs into the systems. Here's a picture from above Redwood Valley. And even, you know, within our region, there are differences. So for example, here we have little ranchettes. You kind of have smaller scale farming operations. This ranchette here looks to be livestock or horses. Above Lake Mendocino here, and in the background, again, more rural residential housing. And just kind of the final observation that we took was, you know, not just the variation of vineyards on the landscape and the variation of practices often between contiguous vineyards, but just the geographic variation, the variation in climate, the variation in, you know, different, even within the same watershed, you know, you can have a fair amount of variation, which affects growing conditions, it affects management practices that may be available for farmers to employ. So that was a good takeaway for us. So after doing kind of that landscape, broad landscape style view, we wanted to get more of a boots on the ground viewpoint of what's happening out in vineyards. And so Again, like I said, we toured over 40 vineyards, and our goals were to understand logistical challenges with what was in the draft order, and we wanted to inform order revisions with the ultimate goal of producing informed regulation. And so we really want to thank the growers that had us out on their farms this winter. We want to thank, you know, just kind of how open and candid you were with us with how your operation works and some of the challenges that you face. Here's kind of the questions that we tended to ask. You know, they know their land. How do they approach erosion and sediment control? You know, how do they manage stormwater discharge on their own land? And what logistical challenges do they face? We also wanted to get a good look of what's already being implemented through these third-party programs. And so we got a good swath of that. And I just want to note that, you know, we tried to see a big geographic variation in vineyards. So we saw a number of representative vineyards in the Santa Rosa area. We went out to Annapolis. We went up to Redwood Valley. We were in Alexander and Anderson Valleys quite a bit. And so, again, just getting a feel for the geographic range in our area, the different scales of vineyard operations. We wanted to see operations that were farmed and owned by the same person. We wanted to see operations that were run by, managed by vineyard management companies. We wanted to see operations that had, you know, a larger staff and a lot of different holdings. So I'll share with you some observations that we had. So one of the main pieces of comment that we got, or the main element that we received in written comments, at least from the grower perspective, was that a lot of the requirements and prohibitions in the draft lacked flexibility to accommodate normal farming practices. So folks pointed out specifically the winterization requirements and prohibitions as particularly problematic, that, you know, there were prohibitions against getting into the vineyard during the winter to do critical needs, like if there's an emergency. You know, folks felt like the draft order as it was written would pose challenges to getting in and performing critical farming practices. And then the 75% ground cover we saw was inflexible and didn't account for kind of the myriad of different conditions that we saw out on the ground at different times of the year. We also observed that some sites that we went to had practices that were already pretty protective of water quality. We saw sites that were employing regenerative practices. We saw a number of sites that already had close to 100% ground cover during the winter. And so really, I kind of want to skip down to that fourth bullet point there. What we really noticed is that there were site-specific conditions that could allow for different approaches that the draft order could take. And then finally, the adaptive management feedback loops that were in the order, we saw that they could be more responsive to acute issues. So these observations kind of allowed us to adopt a change in approach to the revisions in the order. And I know this is a little bit hard to read on the screen now, but I'll read them out. So the first was to have the order focus on higher priority elements, such as the sediment and temperature impairments, and then streamline and simplify the lower priority elements, like the statewide nitrogen requirements. So if we assume that, you know, everything takes time, money, and resources, and there's a finite number of that, where do we want to direct that time, money, and resources through this order? And then the third one is kind of along those same lines, is that the order should focus on higher risk sites and adaptive management in those higher risk sites, and then reduce the regulatory burden for lower risk sites. So again, this one's a bit hard to read, but the intended revisions, kind of as we developed them, we wanted them to incorporate our board's direction that this order consider threat and complexity. So again, it goes along with what I was saying, that it should focus on higher threat sites and kind of reduce the number of things a grower would have to do if they have a lower risk site or they're already implementing practices that are working. The second is that the revisions should increase the flexibility to account for all the different farming practices that we saw out there, the different site conditions, and the different climate conditions from year to year. We have drought years, we have years where we get multiple big storms, January, February, et cetera. Third, that the revisions should generally shift kind of that representative broad scale monitoring down towards adaptive management on the higher risk sites. So again, it gets to that, if there's limited time, resources, money, where are those resources being allocated in this order? And we thought, that should shift towards, on-farm improvements. And then finally, because folks are already utilizing existing voluntary programs, where can we utilize that for efficiency, for cost savings, and those, basically the relationship and trust that have been built with growers over the years, and that itself could lead to better compliance outcomes. Okay, so we have five revisions that we want to talk with you about today. The first two are going to take a bit longer to explain, and the last three we'll be able to move through fairly quickly. Okay, so I'm going to spend just a few minutes on this slide here because there's a lot to explain here. So what the main kind of concern that we heard related to sediment and erosion control as it was in the draft order was that it was inflexible. The dates were inflexible. They didn't account for changes year to year. And basically the minimum practices that were in there, I'll remind you, it was a 75% minimum ground cover between November 15th and April 1st. And so folks felt that was overly prescriptive, it was inflexible, and in some cases it was incompatible with necessary farming practices over the winter. We also had winterization prohibitions that, again, we heard feedback, and when we visited vineyard sites, saw for ourselves that there were some things that needed to get done during that winterization period that the draft order didn't necessarily account for. These revisions also incorporate the direction that our board members gave us to consider threat and complexity in the establishment of requirements, and also assumes that vineyard water quality threat and complexity is primarily a function of slope, of ground cover, and the presence of agricultural drainage structures. So we'll walk through these real quick. Instead of the minimum management practice to have 75% ground cover in the vineyard during that winterization period and the winterization prohibitions, enrollees would be able to choose one of three different compliance options to meet their sediment erosion control requirements. The first one is still a minimum ground cover, but it's based on slope this time. And so between December 15th and April 1st, based on the slope in the enrollee's vineyard, they can choose to meet one of those minimum ground cover requirements. And that would be ground cover over the farmed area. It would be the area that has vines and the appurtenant areas of the vineyard that are used for the farming operation. The second compliance option is that a enrollee could develop a sediment erosion control plan through an approved voluntary program. And so what we're doing right now is we're working with a number of these voluntary programs that already exist to kind of vet the program, and there's going to be a request for qualification process that these go through, so such that at the end of the process, we're going to have programs that have been vetted that their sediment erosion control element of their program, provides commensurate protection to our, option one here, and folks can use that program as their sediment erosion control compliance. The third compliance option is that enrollees can develop, implement, and submit their own sediment erosion control plan. So that would be, if someone says, well, I can't meet the minimum ground cover, but I have this other management practice I'm employing in my vineyard. I don't really want to work with an existing program. I kind of just want to do it myself. So there's an option for folks to do that as well. Okay. So that ties into the requirements that, you know, the winterization requirements that were in the draft. So we made some revisions to those as well, in concert with our sediment erosion control compliance options. So the winterization prohibitions that were in the draft order that basically said you can't get into your vineyard during saturated soil conditions, those have been removed. And instead, there's this provision that we're proposing that if you go in and you have to go in to, for example, fix a well that broke in the middle of winter, and you drive in saturated soil conditions, you just fix the damage. We've retained some prohibitions related to new development and replant activities. Those dates are consistent with those same development and replant prohibitions that are that exist in VESCO. And then for temporary sediment and erosion control measures, like I said, enrollees can access the vineyard for critical needs. And also, if enrollees are choosing to meet the minimum ground cover requirements, you know, between December 15th and April 1st, we have a provision in there that if there's a qualifying storm event that happens before December 1st, that they install temporary erosion and sediment control measures and have them accessible installed. And so that kind of allowed us to shift the date from when you have to have ground cover established from November 15th to December 15th, because we got feedback that, you know, the November 15th date in many years, ground cover is not established yet. And so by making it December 15th, it gives a really clear start date. But if we have a storm before then, enrollees are going to have to install temporary measures to control sediment discharge. So let's walk through those with a couple of scenarios. So in these are going to be pretty simple examples, but they're just to illustrate kind of how a grower would approach the intended revision for both of those. So here's a vineyard that is flat and there are no agricultural drainage structures. So the vine row spacing and their strip spray width for this vineyard puts them over the 50% ground cover over the winter. So kind of a couple questions to consider. What options does this enrollee have available to them to comply with the sediment erosion control requirements as we've proposed in this intended revision? And then how would the order address any erosion? So because this vineyard is already meeting the minimum practices, let me go back to this slide. So really, they would have any of these compliance options available to them. They're already meeting the minimum ground cover through a combination of their cultural practices and the slope on their vineyard. So they could say, I'm meeting the minimum ground cover, that I'm in compliance. Or they can use their existing voluntary program that's been approved through us, or they could develop and submit their own sediment erosion control plan. If there are, you know, erosion in this vineyard, you know, that happened, the order also has this requirement that folks address their controllable sediment discharge sources. And that exists regardless of what compliance option someone chooses. So over time, if an issue develops, if there's erosion in the vineyard, the order still requires that an enrollee address that. Okay, in this second very simple scenario, you have a sloped vineyard with the same vine row spacing and strip spray geometry. So, you know, we can ask what options are available to this enrollee for their sediment and erosion control compliance. So they don't meet the minimum ground cover requirements for their slope, and we'll go back here. So they don't meet this option one right now. So their options are basically they can change their cultural practices to meet the minimum ground cover, or they can work with an approved voluntary program to develop a sediment erosion control plan, or they can develop their own sediment erosion control plan. So they still have, you know, three options. If they want to change their cultural practices, if they want to continue farming, they can work with a voluntary program or develop their own plan that shows that they're meeting commensurate protection in another way through implementation of other management practices. And then because they have ag drainage structures, you know, they're using the monitoring of those ag drainage structures to show that those management practices are indeed working. And we're going to talk about the revisions to that section of the order right now. Okay, so this is just a slide kind of reminding us about the ag drainage structure sampling requirement that's in the draft order. This is another area that we received a considerable amount of comment on. So we want to talk about it for a little bit. So just to remind everyone, ag drainage structures are basically constructed features that hold and convey water that are in hydrologic connection to other surface waters. And so pictured are just some general examples, you know, anything that basically has an inlet and an outlet, that's an ag drainage structure, but it can also be, you know, things that are drainages that are constructed. Okay, so there are a few revisions to talk about related to this. One of the comments that we got was that the adaptive management kind of feedback loop that existed in the draft was not very responsive to issues. And so this revision basically requires a more timely response if there are exceedances of the turbidity benchmark. And basically what that means is, you know, an enrollee would have to go out and install temporary repairs and monitor during the next storm. And the rationale for that is just basically, if you know there's a problem, you know, there's an opportunity to go out and basically put a Band-Aid on it. You know, you can put out a straw wattle or hay bales to try to attempt to control the discharge from the ag drainage structure. The kind of iterative structure where it moves, the adaptive management moves through these different steps and the schedule of it those haven't been changed. It's just that, you know, immediately following a benchmark exceedance, an enrollee would be required to try to go out and quickly triage the issue and install some temporary measures to fix whatever's happening on a temporary way. We also got a number of comments about the difficulty in doing this sampling because of off-site run-on. And indeed, we spent a lot of time over the winter visiting sites where there were quite complex run-on situations. And we noticed that, you know, there were basically two main categories. There was off-site run-on that came onto the vineyard and, you know, ran into the ag drainage structure network, and the run-on coming on might already be turbid. There was also a situations where you could have run-on, for example, coming from a road that you know, runs onto the vineyard and itself causes erosion in the vineyard. And that's problematic because, you know, this order doesn't intend to hold enrollees responsible for the runoff coming onto their vineyard and you know, and causing erosion from something that they can't control. So, you know, we really realized that the draft order was not clear and not specific enough for how folks are supposed to deal with this. And so there's basically two options for folks. If off-site run-on is coming onto the property and running into the ag drainage structure network, we specified in this revision specifies how to discount those sources from the ag drainage structure sampling results. And then it also removes the requirement that an enrollee has to wait 4 years of sampling to determine that the off-site stormwater run-on is creating erosion and causing benchmark exceedances. So again, it kind of refines and clarifies what to do for off-site run-on. And we can talk about kind of how all that will work in this next simple, albeit example. So here's the same vineyard from before with its five ag drainage structures. And I'll kind of remind folks of what's in the order, what's required in the order. So the ag drainage structure monitoring, as it currently stands in the draft, is that folks would have to monitor, you know, their ag drainage structures once every 5 years. But there's this additional provision that you monitor 20% every year. So This person has 5 ag drainage structures. They would monitor once a year and then go back and start with number one again. So if we take kind of just take one of them, the one on the far left, for example, let's say that one has a couple different sources of offsite run-on that are, you know, flowing into the inlet that's feeding that discharge location. So what would this enrollee do to comply with these requirements? So they would sample that outlet once every 5 years. If it was over the benchmark, if it was over the 250 NTU benchmark threshold, they would have an option of going and sampling any of the offsite sources that are running into that inlet and that they could discount. There's a methodology in order to do that. If it still exceeded, they would be required under this revision to install some temporary sediment erosion control measures. So for example, if they went out there and saw that, you know, hey, this road is, you know, might be discharging sediment into my inlet here, maybe it's putting up a wattle. Maybe they need to muck out their inlet. You know, maybe it's putting straw bales around the outlet that's discharging to try to, you know, stop the discharge of sediment there. So there are options that enrollee would have to deal with that immediate kind of issue there. And then they would monitor it the next storm. And if everything's good, then they move on. And over the summer, they try to, you know, further triage what the issue was. So, you know, maybe the road needs a little extra work. Maybe there needs to be a water bar put in, for example. So that's kind of how that adaptive management feedback scenario would work. Okay, and then the final revision we wanted to talk to you about related to ag drainage structure monitoring was kind of related to a few observations that we made over the winter. The first one is that some sites are already implementing max ground cover during the winter. And so some eased monitoring requirements could incentivize these practices. And it also goes back to kind of our philosophical shift in, you know, reducing the regulatory burden for low-risk sites. Again, this assumes that the threat and complexity of a vineyard is a function of its slope, of its ground cover, and the presence of ag drainage structures. There's also this requirement in the draft order that at the end of adaptive management, if you keep having these exceedances in your ag drainage structure monitoring, you have to get a sediment erosion and control plan certified by a qualified professional. So our rationale is that if someone seeks a sediment erosion control plan certified by a qualified professional right away, then that would be, that would be enough to exempt them from the ag drainage structure monitoring because they're getting that professional oversight. So, you know, in this proposed revision, enrollee may opt to become exempt from monitoring their ag drainage structures through meeting one of two of these requirements. They could either meet a more robust ground cover in their vineyard than what the minimum compliance option we talked about before was, or they could have their sediment erosion and control plan certified by a qualified professional. Okay, there are just 3 more revisions that we want to talk with you about today, and we can move through these a bit quicker. So in the draft, we had for third-party group monitoring, kind of this suite of proposed representative monitoring. One of them was continuous turbidity monitoring, and that was proposed in 3 locations. And so we got a number of public comment about these representative monitoring elements, that there was difficulty in interpreting the results over time, given the different sources of sediment in our watersheds. And then, you know, it incorporates our general philosophical shift away from the long-scale representative monitoring towards more timely adaptive management at the farm level. Again, it's the time, resources, money, there's a finite amount of it, and where do we want to have this order directed? So again, this revision proposes that we eliminate that element from the draft. The next is we heard a lot of public comment about the impact to smaller farmers. The cost and the regulatory burden don't necessarily scale with acreage. And so someone that has a very small farming operation where they're, you know, barely breaking even, if that, you know, there's some rationale that we looked at that would allow this exemption. We had analysis that indicated that vineyard parcels that are less than 5 acres of planted to vines were about 2% of the total land planted to vineyards in our region, but those parcels represented over 30% of the unique parcels planted to vineyards. We should note that that is the maximum because, of course, people hold multiple parcels. And so in this revision, enrollees that have a combined holding of planted vines that don't exceed 5 acres could be exempt from enrollment. So I'll say it another way. If you just own 5 acres and no more, you could be exempt from enrolling in this order. However, we retained a provision that the executive officer could require enrollment of any commercial vineyard. Okay, the final revision we want to talk to you about is related to our statewide precedential requirements. And I'll kind of remind you again, they are related to groundwater monitoring, they're related to nitrogen reporting, and they're related to what are called, in general, groundwater protection. And quite simply, it requires that either the regional board or the third-party group develop these groundwater protection targets that would prevent, a degradation of nitrate into our groundwater. So those last two, the nitrogen reporting and the groundwater protection, are related to how we designate our groundwater basins. In the draft order, we designated our priority one groundwater basins in the region as high vulnerability. And the state water board doesn't really direct us specifically how to designate groundwater basins. It just says, here are the factors you have to consider. And, you know, upon further reflection, you know, we noticed that there were data gaps because it doesn't necessarily, the way that we designated, you know, our groundwater basins in the draft didn't take kind of a focused agricultural perspective. It didn't take kind of the nitrogen data that we may have out there. So the intended revision here is to delay the determination of high vulnerability groundwater basins. And what that would do is it would delay a number of those precedential requirements specifically related to certifying nitrogen reports and developing groundwater protection targets. And so growers would still have to report how much nitrogen they're using, but they wouldn't have to get it certified. And then we wouldn't have to, you know, develop groundwater protection targets until those groundwater basins get designated. And how we propose to do that is to wait until an initial period of data collection that we would do through the order, through the groundwater monitoring, through the nitrogen reporting, and then we would determine which groundwater basins, if any, should be high vulnerability. So here is our schedule for the next 6 months. After the meeting here, we're gonna go back this summer and finalize the revisions to the draft vineyard order. We also have a response to comments document that we're developing, and that is going to, basically, it is what it sounds like. It's us, the staff, responding to the written comments that we received during the public comment period. And that will be released with our proposed vineyard order in October. So there will be a proposed order, a response to comments document, a summary of changes to the draft, and our environmental impact report released in October. And then we'll come back in December. That starts our adoption window for the vineyard order and the certification of our environmental impact report. Okay, so that concludes our presentation. I wanted to leave the slide up for our contact information, and let's take a 10-minute break. After that, we're gonna come back and we'll have an opportunity for you to come up and provide us input. It doesn't necessarily have to be on the revisions, but of course we would love to hear your input on the revisions that we just presented, and if you have any questions for us. And for those in the Zoom, we're going to allow you to have a period of public input as well. And so when we come back from the break, we'll give you instructions on how to get in the queue to provide comment. All right. Okay, so it's 6:10. We're going to go ahead and get started. It's quite warm in this room here, so we'll probably start with input in this room first so you folks can get back to your air conditioning, and then we'll get to the folks on Zoom. So real quick, just so we can keep track of if we need a time limit on comments, can the folks in the room and the folks on Zoom who want to provide input, can you just raise your hands so we get an idea of how many people want to talk? Folks in the room and three on Zoom. Okay. Okay, so I know initially we said that we wanted you to keep your comments to 3 minutes, but it looks like we'll have time if you, you don't have to necessarily keep it limited. Obviously, you know, we don't want an hour dialogue, but but we don't have to necessarily keep it limited to 3 minutes. So with that, we'll just open it up to input in the room. Just feel free to come up to the mic up there in the middle, and we'll just go... Whenever you see the mic empty, head up and give us input. Thank you.
Feels very formal. Noelle Kramers with Wine Institute. First, thank you. That was helpful overview, but also really appreciate all the work that you've done in listening and meeting with folks to better understand the comments that were raised earlier. And we recognize all of the changes that have been made and appreciate them. I had one question and then one request. So in a situation where you might be trying to meet the 90% ground cover so that you don't have to monitor, how would it work? So let's say you have a year where you get early rains and a warm fall and winter and you meet the 90%. So then you don't monitor. And then the next year, it's much colder, and you don't get the germination, and you don't have 90% by December 15th. Like, how does that work? Because you're, and then the next year, maybe you don't get rain, so it's not germ. Like, how does it work year to year if you're not, if some years you meet it and some years you don't?
So that's kind of part of the, that part of the revision we're still working on finalizing. You know, we're thinking about options like, can that be averaged over a certain number of years? So can there, for example, be, I'm going to certify that for the next 5 years, on average, I'm going to meet this ground cover requirement. That is one option. Another option is to go year to year, and if you don't meet it in a particular year, you monitor. So we haven't landed on a particular answer yet, but that revision in particular, we're still working on to figure out, you know, we do recognize that there are, you know, weather differences every year, and someone may easily meet it 1 year and not the next. And then and also in certain parts of their vineyard, they may meet it, and other parts of their vineyard, they may not meet it. So we're trying to figure out a simple, if possible, and, you know, straightforward way for folks to demonstrate that.
Okay, thank you. And then the other request is, so I know folks are aware of the plan by the State Water Board to reconvene a second ag expert panel. Just want to ask if there's a possibility for the regional board to submit a request to ask for more flexibility and a recognition of the low nitrogen inputs in vineyards so that that could be recognized and considered by the ag expert panel to give you more flexibility in some of the nitrogen requirements. So, thank you.
Thanks, Noelle.
I guess I'll go and get this over with. I did sincerely want to thank you guys for all your hard work. It's such an important permit, and it's, you know, it's long overdue, and, you know, we've been fighting really hard to save these salmon and our creeks, so this is really welcome effort. And one of the concerns I have right now is just that the stream setbacks don't seem to be the buffer areas. They're not changed from what I gather. And so that concerns me a lot that we have impaired water tributaries all over the region, especially in the Russian River, and we're not addressing this problem. And we have some areas that really are, you know, lacking even the minimum. And I'm hoping that you guys will consider, you know, in the permit, moving towards healthy, dark, thick riparian vegetation on all vineyards that are adjacent to watercourses, because I don't see that here, and it seems like it's really important to meet the needs of these creeks. And you guys are the water quality folks, and we feel like this is kind of really clearly in your wheelhouse. And another point is just that we want a permit that's really based on science, and so there may be other factors that are coming up, but if we don't have discharges that meet, you know, really robust monitoring and science-based standards, then I think that we're going to waste a lot of time. So I would like to see, you know, robust monitoring and the that data to be available. And then just also, I did see some changes in there that I liked in your revision, so I want to thank you for some of those. I think that might be all I have right now, but I might come back, if that's okay. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Kimberly.
Good afternoon. I'm Mike Martini. I live in Santa Rosa. I just want to make three comments, if I may, quickly. First of all, I do want to acknowledge and express my appreciation for the work, Brenna, that you and your staff have done in going out and seeing vineyards and how they actually operate. But having done that, I still think there's additional work that needs to be done. The three areas of concern I have is on the issue of the run-on. I think that's how you refer to it. You know, one of the issues is, yes, I understand you're making some revisions that allow the grower to deduct the run-on, but the burden of identifying that run-on still falls financially to the grower. And at some point, is the regional board, while you're working with the vineyards on these sediment issues, you've got significant residential uses, county uses, state uses in their water that is adding to the problem. Will the board go after those individuals and keep that off of the vineyard properties? The second piece to it is, you know, as you've already seen in your vineyard visits, so many of our vineyard operators are already participating in programs that are going much 90%, 95% of the way that you want them to get to. We have VESCO, we have all of the third party kinds of things. They're doing the job that needs to be done. Adding another layer of regulatory requirements doesn't really change the fact that they're doing the right thing. What you're after are the guys who aren't doing the right thing, and quite frankly, they're going to ignore what you're doing. And the people who are already doing the right thing, all they have is additional regulatory burden. You really haven't moved the ship of state forward at all. And then the final piece to it is, as I think you really have to think about, you know, that whole issue of the complexity of where these sediment things are coming from and how you're going to monitor them. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Good evening, and thank you for, my name is Don McNair, with Russian Riverkeeper. Thank you for all the times you've met with us, as well as all the other people involved in this. I think the outcome of the revisions that we've seen so far is positive. You've heard me many times talk about just the inappropriateness of some of the statewide presidential requirements. So I would echo what I just heard, that really having discretion, I mean, our region really isn't like the Eastern San Joaquin where the presidential requirements came from, nor do we have those profound groundwater and other issues that they do there. So one thing I really appreciate about the revisions is there's a lot more flexibility in this. And I think most growers know their land. They're experts of their properties. They know farming. I think providing them with flexibility so that they can make decisions based on their years of experience and everyone makes perfect sense. And just to follow on what Mike just said, you know, from, as you know, from 2015 to 2018, we collected hundreds of water quality samples from the edge of vineyards, paired them with photographs of the practices, and, you know, really only sample places where the runoff represented only that vineyard. There was no run-on or anything. The person who did the majority of the sampling was a water board member, and we saw results ranging from 5 NTU, which is very clean, clear water, almost drinking water, and 4,000 NTU, which is liquid dirt. And I think, again, not to pick on Mike, but he said some smart things, and that's that, you know, it's those people at the 4,000 we want to focus on. And I think this permit is really going in that direction, and we so appreciate it. The one thing we learned most from our sampling was that there's a lot of correlation between vineyard practices and runoff quality. And the biggest thing that we saw, the most clear correlation, was beer dirt and turbidity levels. So we really appreciate the focus on cover crops. That's good. You know, we see beer dirt producing, on average, the highest discharge levels. That said, as you know, there are farmers who do some heavy tilling, even ripping their vineyards annually, but they have their own practices where they incorporate compost and other things, and some of those vineyards produce the lowest quality runoff. So the flexibility, again, allows farmers to farm, and that's good. You know, I'm happy to say this winter when we were out, compared to the period we were sampling, you know, we saw many vineyards that had created a lot of problems. We saw high turbidity levels have completely different practices on the land. So we're seeing a lot of movement in the right direction. And, you know, often it's because they've got increased cover crops. They're reducing their herbicide use or reducing their spray pattern. And that makes a big difference. I also think there's a lot of value in third-party programs. Although there's one thing in third-party programs, none of them have what's required here, which is an effectiveness feedback loop. That's required by state law. None of them do sampling. No one's benchmarking. They're measuring outputs. They're going, okay, did we do this, did we do that? But no one's measuring what is the outcome of those outputs. So we appreciate that there is, you know, sampling out there. And I think, you know, just before I forget, if I was anyone who had a big run-on problem, anyone in the public can call you and file a complaint. So that's a great way to start a problem that's ending up in your vineyard getting resolved. But I think having baseline requirements of third-party programs, coupling it with some level of monitoring, gets us to what we need, which is that effectiveness feedback loop, so that the public, the grower community, fellow growers, everyone knows that people's activities are resulting in minimization of sediment runoff. They need that dirt in their vineyard to farm. So, and last, just appreciate this is moving forward. As some of the people in this room probably were up in Reading with me many, many years ago. I think it's almost been 12, 15 years. So this is a long time coming, and I'm glad you're getting closer and closer to the finish line. And just thank you again for all your time meeting with us and listening to everyone who's involved in this permit.
Thank you, Don.
Getting made fun of, but that's okay. Brenna and Chris, thank you very much. I already thanked you, but I met with you, showed you some vineyard projects. I really appreciate that, and I think I made two new friends. We probably didn't agree on most things, but I still do like you, even though you work for the state. But I was thinking, I was maybe really hoping that there'd be someone here who wrote this order here tonight, you know, and I agreed with everybody that come up here so far, but well, this is kind of tough for a farmer here. I showed you some of my projects, and you really didn't answer them tonight of how we have the run on and the runoff. I don't know how to do that, and I still won't know how to do that when we get all done. And I've already told you this, because I had my little script, and you guys already heard it, and I don't want to bore you, but I'm a teeny bit, I've been doing this for a long time, and I'm almost insulted. You know, we have a sustainable program. We've been regenerative farming before that term was invented. Been doing that all my life. And, you know, we do a pretty good job at it. Stayed in business all these years from growing prunes, pears, apples, now grapes, and tree fruit, which is tree fruit. I don't have to worry about the tree fruit. That I can have runoff. I'm okay with that one. But I might plant more olives. But, you know, we have third-party inspection on our sustainable program. We have third-party inspection. We adhere to all these things, and we really adhere to these things to be legal and do it. We do it, and we work really hard at that. And we not only look at just runoff from our vineyards or whatever. I mean, we have a project on our ranch, and we'll change out light bulbs. We'll change them out. We'll change the fixtures. We do a lot of things. We got to put solar. We do whatever it takes. That program that we adhere to is a really a good program. But I know that doesn't do anything about the runoff. But the slide that you showed there with the vineyard flooding in the Laguna area, I'm going to tell you again, and we're talking about runoff and run on and run off. The city of Santa Rosa, and you heard the speech, but you can't tell me to be quiet, I guess, but you can shut me up in 2.5 minutes. But, you know, the Santa Rosa Creek starts above Melita Road, above. Give you. I'm a farmer, Mel Sanchetti farmer in Sonoma County here in West Sonoma County, Sebastopol area. So that creek starts above Melita Road, above Santa Rosa, comes down through the channel. Then when it hits the town, it goes into a tube, okay? Goes under City Hall, goes underneath the 101 freeway. And then it goes in to, it's supposed to be, it's not the Santa Rosa Creek, it's a flood channel that was built about 50 years ago, and I watched it, and it's straight shot. It's not the creek, it's a flood channel. You got willows and berries and crap growing there now, but it's a flood channel. That was completely full probably when you took that picture, because on a rainy day I watched this stuff happen with all the chocolate, the antifreeze, the water that comes off the pavement, the spent tires that are on the pavement, the droppings from your fuel and oil that are on the pavement from the city, ends up in the Laguna. That vineyard picture you saw was from the city of Santa Rosa that came down there and dumped out there. There was no vineyard. There's no vineyard there. There was vineyard there, but that didn't contribute to that water. And it dumps into the Laguna. So, like most of our home ranch, that's where it dumps also, into the Laguna. So, boy, you know, I and then it goes into the Russian River. City of Santa Rosa, the state, the county of Sonoma, they don't clean up their act. They're not doing anything to make ditches, creeks, anything better. So you go out to our ranch in Green Valley Road where the water goes out of the Green Valley Creek, out of the creek, over the ranch, ran over the ranch at least 30 days this winter, over the ranch. We have a pond that's over 100 years old there. Goes over the top of the bank into the pond, and we still have a problem with the state of California because we're taking their water. We're taking their water. No one can figure out how to report this, but $1,500 a year that we've been working on for 25 years makes it okay. You know, it makes it okay. So is the state who's not allowing the county or anything to do anything with the Green Valley Creek? Are they going to report? Are they going to test the water? I mean, if we're all in this together. Plus, what's the cost on this? What is the, you know, farmers, we budget, margins are getting tight. I know Fish and Wildlife, they own about 200 acres of land around our properties that are in ag preserves, wetland preserves. I just have a chat with them all the time when they're going to do fire protection, when they're going to do fire prevention. So June 10th, they're going to come mow a 40-foot strip around these 200 acres, and they're going to call it done because they can't do anything else because they don't have a budget for it. Well, you know, as farmers here, I don't have a budget set up to do this. So plus originally I told you I don't want to do anything. I'll do all this on my own. I think we do a good a real farmer does a good job because you don't want to lose soil. You want to do everything properly when you're farming. The bad actors, as Mike said, they're not going to do, you're going to do whatever you want, and they're still not going to do anything. They're not. I mean, I've been doing this a long time. So thank you for listening.
Thanks, Mel, and thanks for showing us the different unique circumstances on your properties. It was really helpful for us.
And I also kind of wanted to address, Mel, you brought up something that it's important us to note here, that the revisions that we've presented today, they're not comprehensive. It's not every revision that we've made, and they're not complete. And so your specific situation, we're still working through how to account for floodwater. It's not the intent of the draft order to make people monitor floodwater. The intent is to monitor stormwater, specifically the inputs that, you know, someone's vineyard has. So, you know, we're working through how to be specific about what someone does about floodwater. So it wasn't in the revisions today, but we are working on that. And then in regards to the cost, you know, we did get written comments that, you know, identified that they thought that we had underestimated the cost of the program. And so one of the things that we're working on once the revisions get finalized is an updated cost estimate.
The cost. So will this be, how will this happen? Is this, you know, sit on the GSA board of Santa Rosa Plain, and the costs there go on your tax roll administered by the County of Sonoma. So it's put on your taxes. And it goes along with my three other bond measures for the hospital that I don't have a hospital in, but that's another issue. But so will this be the same way?
I think, you know, when we were out walking around, you mentioned that you also do some farming over in the valley and that you're part of a coalition there and you pay into it. Our expectations that it'll be similar to that.
So what I did bring up was the local Farm Bureau, who's very, very well known in our Sonoma County. So that's where you would head towards the Farm Bureau administering this, and they would collect and
we've been working with them to help get them prepared for that, and they seem very engaged in doing that.
But you don't have a clue of what, is this going to be per acre? If you get rid of the turbidity testing in this, is that going to, it'll be all inclusive in if they do it?
That's a possibility. I mean, I think it might be the best way to do it.
So you don't have a number?
We put out a number under the draft order.
I don't. Well, I'll read. I didn't.
Yeah. I could look it up.
That's right. Okay. No, that's okay. So it's going to cost something. And I'll just, you know, I don't want to pay anything, and I don't want to do this, but okay, thank you.
Okay, last call for, here we go.
Holly Smith, just a citizen, not an expert, just someone living in the county for like 50 years. And totally enjoy wine country and everything it has to offer, and feel like a lot of the vineyards are doing a great job. Some of them are doing a marvelous job. And I'm a kayaker, so I spend a lot of time in the water, and I see a lot of things, some good, some bad. But I just want to support the idea of the ordinance. It seems like we're in changing times where water is more scarce and water is being fought over left and right all over the state, and we need to keep an eye on what's going on. And I hope it's not too much of a burden to the vineyards. It seems like if a vineyard's doing the right thing, that somehow it could just be rubber stamped and be easy for them if it's something they can just turn in that they're already doing. But anyway, we know that it's that small percent that we're trying to capture here that's a problem, and just appreciate your efforts. All right.
Thanks for your comment.
Having driven this far, I need to talk. First of all, I want to thank you all for doing this. The timeline was terrifying. I knew it was long. I'd forgotten probably purposefully that it was that long. So thanks for that and for being receptive to so many people, so many diverse opinions and perspectives. It's really, it's the best way to go forward, I think. I also wanted to thank you specifically for identifying programs that work, because one of the things that you noted was the number of programs that are not working is really very small compared to, especially as operators have learned more and more about how to stabilize soil and they've gotten better at it. And so now we're looking at the few that are still problematic. One of the things I really want to note is that you should not assume, nobody should assume, that the massive turnout is not here because people don't care. People do care, but notification was pretty thin, and it's a long way from the population hubs to Cloverdale. So I think it's really important to note that the history of water quality and water issues in Sonoma and Mendocino counties and the entire North Coast is full of people who really do care. They just can't show up on a Thursday night. There is a legally required feedback loop, as you know, and data collection must include objective, measurable, outcome, goal-relatable reporting, so adaptations are appropriate to the impacts and they're timely. And I think that isn't emphasized enough in order to really reach achievable goals, because if we don't know what's going on, then we can't possibly address it. So data-driven, objective, measurable outcomes is really, really critically important. And public information is also important and required by law. So if we can get information that's readily available in some form or other to the public, then you'll have more eyes on than you can just individually. I know you're staff constrained. So thank you again for the years of work.
Thanks for your comment.
So the first time being here at one of these, and so I'm still learning. I am a member of the public, and I've been around in Sonoma County for way too long, and I appreciate the work that you're doing. And especially noting the ground cover aspect, because in my traveling around the Sonoma County, I see that there are vineyards that have no ground cover, and the reason I'm seeing them is because they're up on gradients. They're up on hillsides, and so I'm, you know, very concerned about some of these. It's not very many, but they're extreme. They're very noticeable when I'm traveling around. So I want to thank you for your work, and I'll probably come to the next one, and maybe I'll know more at that point. Thank you.
Brenna, is that good? Brenna, Chris, thank you for meeting with, you know, us earlier this year and everything. Really enjoyed, you know, discussing everything with you. Just want to make a couple quick comments. If there's any consideration being taken into, like, non-till vineyards, you know, for some of the slopes and everything. I mean, I'm not a math genius, but I don't think that we meet on some of our vineyards, you know, maybe the 75% cover with our, you know, herbicide sprays and whatnot. You know, we do try to
we do that, you know, so we can mow one pass there with our permanent turf and not, you know, non-till and everything. You know, greenhouse gases and all, so we just want to make one pass through the vineyard if we can. You know, so the 75%, you know, would really limit us, I think. But if it was a non-till, you know, vineyard, less likely to erode. I wonder if there'd be any consideration for that. And then also, you know, I wish there would be some talk about one of the biggest pests we have, especially out in West County, is gophers. And I think they're one of the biggest problem of all the, you know, the erosion that we have out there. But, you know, the state's trying to stop us from, you know, getting rid of those as well. But anyways, that was my comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry about the noise. I'm Kim Wallace, and I have to admit I feel somewhat unqualified to speak. I'm not a viticulturalist. I'm not a farmer. I'm not a vineyard manager, but I am a lifelong resident of the Dry Creek Valley, and I'm a member of a family-owned winery that has managed to stay in business for 52 years, and we do own vineyards. And I know very little about this, and to be honest, I don't understand an awful lot. I don't know what a TMDL is. There were a whole bunch of things you said that kind of went over my head, but what I do know about is the wine industry. And I know about running a winery. And I know about the relationship between farmers and growers and the winery. And I don't know if you've heard, but right now the wine industry and grape growers and farmers are going through a very tough time. Now, we are arguably a successful family-owned winery. We've been in business 52 years. And it is, I would say, the hardest I've seen ever. And I know as a family that not only we farm our own vineyards, and my vineyard manager is here, we also buy grapes from roughly 20, 25 small family-owned growers, mostly all in Dry Creek Valley. In fact, all in Dry Creek Valley. And they are struggling. Just the complexity of learning about this stuff, and as one gentleman talked about, the increased costs and the increased administrative costs and all of the stuff that goes into having to deal with these types of regulatory issues on top of all the other new regulations that we are being thrown at left and right. I can't even tell you how hard it is, you guys, and I think the thing that worries me the most is that, you know, what's going to happen if farmers just say to heck with it. This is, you know, nobody's making any money, or very little. Well, you know what's going to happen? All those beautiful vineyards are going to be torn out or sold, and more people will be moving to the area, and, you know, it's going to be paving over paradise. Look at what happened to Orange County or other parts of California that now are, you know, awash with subdivisions. So it might seem a little bit like I'm exaggerating, but I'm not. And I guess I wanted to just tell you, you know, as someone who runs a winery and has been in business, I really worry about how difficult this will be. I actually had a grower, a neighbor of mine, call me last week. It's not somebody we buy grapes from. And he sat in my office and offered to give us his grapes. You know what? We don't need them because we don't need that wine. We can't sell it. So he has no, I can't even, there's so many growers that do not have contracts right now. So I guess my whole point is I just wanted to sort of share a different side of it that hadn't been spoken about this evening. And so, but it sounds like you've made a lot of good progress, and I hope the revisions can continue to evolve and maybe be a little bit more amenable to our growers. Thank you.
Thanks for your comment. All right, anyone else in the room here who would like to provide some input? All right, we're going to go to the Zoom room. So we'll go by order that the hands are raised. So first up, we have Carrie Fisher. And Carrie, I'm going to bring you up and allow you to unmute here. So just give me a sec. Good.
Hello, Carrie Fisher with California Farm Bureau Federation. I just had a clarifying question. I appreciate all the information that was shared today. And it's with respect to the potential timeline that you were talking about, Brenna, with the proposed order in response to comments and the DEIR being, I wrote down, released in October, and then you're wanting to go to the board in December. And I just would caution, since I've worked on every single irrigated lands program throughout the state, and even started on this one before I had kids, and now my kids are quite large and big. With the proposed order response to comments and a draft EIR, just to please have enough time for the public comment period, especially since we're going into holidays in November. And I, obviously you guys would want to see all of that before it goes to the board. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for your comment, Carrie. All right, next up we have Gail Seymour. So Gail, just a sec, let me bring you up and unmute you.
I'm ready. I'm ready to go?
Yep, you should be good.
I'm not sure how to put the video on this thing. Is there a way to do that? I guess not. Okay, so thank you for the opportunity to comment. And I'm Gail Seymour. I'm retired from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. I was one of those people 20 years ago that was hiking through creeks, surveying and analyzing the habitat for salmon and steelhead. Did a lot in the Russian River. I'm currently a citizen scientist and the chair of the local NAACP Environmental Justice Committee. First of all, I want to say thank you to all of you for at the staff for being so receptive to everyone's concerns and recommendations. I really appreciate that. It was very professional. So I have concerns that all underserved communities were not contacted. BIPOC organizations had no idea that a vineyard WDR was under development, and some may think that they don't care. They're not necessarily the regulated community. They're not maybe environmentalists, but they do care. And I appreciate working with your staff and implementing your racial equity policy, but it's unfortunate that more underserved communities are not involved with this current effort. And secondly, I'm going to harp on temperature. You've heard me harp for quite a while. Maybe it's too late to really address any of my suggestions, but I would like it on the record. The temperature of surface waters is a priority element in your WDR draft, and there is elements and conditions that are missing. So as healthy native riparian buffers are necessary for beneficial uses, and as over 90% of riparian buffers in the Russian River watershed have been diminished, and as healthy riparian buffers provide necessary shade to meet temperature as well as dissolved oxygen objectives, temperature should be a greater priority. And I believe the enforcement of the region's temperature policy is via the WDR. Correct me if I'm not correct on that. And there's no benchmarks or requirements for specific surface water temperature monitoring in the WDR. The state non-point source implementation policy requires a monitoring program that verifies the adequacy and effectiveness of the order. And the region's temperature policy requires a specific time schedule and milestones to measure progress so that the regional board, the dischargers, and the public can determine if the program is achieving its goals. And the region's temperature policy actions include installing and maintaining a minimum width of vegetated buffers, reducing diversions of in-stream summer flows, and protecting cold water sources. And I can say firsthand, after all my habitat surveying, that a lot of those cold water springs are what kept those baby fish alive in the tributaries. And the protection and maintenance and enhancement, which I consider restoration of riparian conditions, is necessary to provide the necessary shade to protect our aquatic species. So monitoring must be incorporated. The use of in-stream data loggers and photo monitoring of the riparian buffers is essential, as well as coordination with other agencies such as the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. In fact, I am still in contact with staff and management, and from what I've heard, they didn't know anything about the development of this WDR. And lastly, there's a recommendation in your temperature policy, and this is outside the WDR, of course, to establish a riparian ecology beneficial use. And I think that's vital considering our warming climate that requires us to increase the resiliency of our species and our biodiversity. I'm not sure when the triennial review is coming out, but I think it's fairly soon. So that's all I have tonight. Thank you so much for everything that you've all done so far.
Thank you, Gail. Up next, we have Victor. So Victor, just a sec, let me pull you up. Okay, you should be able to unmute now.
Hi, you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, so I just have one question. So we already have a stormwater permit. You know, we comply with the stormwater regulations that are already in place. We have a SWIP. How is this any different if we're already testing twice a year, we're doing monthly monitoring of our runoff? What do we need to do in addition that we're not already doing?
Victor, this is Chris. Are you a winery owner?
No, I'm the director of operations for a medium-sized winery.
Okay, so I think what you're referring to is a stormwater runoff permit for the winery property itself.
Okay.
And this is covering the vineyards that may be associated with the one. Does your winery you work for also have its own vineyards?
Yeah, we have about 300 acres.
Okay. Right. So this is the permit that for your winery is just for the winery industrial uses, and this is for the agricultural activities on that 300 acres.
It would follow, I imagine, some of the same rules that we have for our SWIP.
I don't know what your SWIP says, but yeah, there are, I think most industrial SWIPs have minimum practices, things you need to do. This would be similar to that, although you may or may not have a SWIP. I'm not sure if is your vineyard enrolled in a program like sustainable wine growing or fish friendly farming, something like that?
Yes.
Okay. You could probably get that, and yeah, I would speak with that entity because ultimately we expect that they will come in and get approved to have their programs fulfill part of the order requirements.
Okay, that's all I have.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, up next we have Devin. Devin, I'll bring it up here. All right, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Good evening. This is Devin Bohr with Mendocino County Farm Bureau. And I just want to express that we appreciate all the time that staff and board members had taken over the last several months to come visit and be on the ground and really sort of work through the conversation with our grower community about how the proposed draft could or could not be really applied. We appreciate the reflections that were made and the changes that were reviewed this evening. That being said, we do have significant concern regarding just sort of the general status of the wine grape industry overall. You've heard directly from some of your grower members tonight about the issues and the economics that we're all facing. And there are ebbs and flows in agriculture. That's how it works. but I do know that in talking with our members, there is significant concern about, you know, how we can manage to continue to work through this program and make any amendments as possible to look at the overall bottom line and the economics involved with how we can apply good stewardship practices for water quality and continue to do so while remaining viable as an industry. So I just wanted to highlight that this evening. You know, Farm Bureau will continue to engage in this in multiple ways. We're still not quite sure 100% of where we're going to fall in terms of our partnerships moving forward on some of the administrations of these programs. But we look forward to continuing those conversations with staff as this process evolves. And we will continue to submit comment. I just encourage staff to continue to work with the regulated community to listen to the concerns and find a way to make this program workable so that there are achieved goals at the end that for looking at water quality standards as well as maintaining the industry. So thank you.
Thanks, Devin. Are there any other folks on Zoom who would like to provide some input? Oh, I see. Jamie, you have your hand up. Let me bring you up here. Okay, Jamie, go ahead. You should be able to unmute.
Hi. Thank you for the presentation tonight and going over the different revisions. My name is Jamie Neary, and I'm here with Russian River Keeper tonight. And to start, I'd just like to say thank you to staff and everyone that has been involved in this process. There's been a lot of discussion and a lot of time and resources put into getting this draft where it is today. That said, we do believe that more can and should be done to protect our water quality from sediment discharges. Not to say that there aren't vineyards already doing everything right, and there shouldn't be incentives to continue those practices, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all vineyards are there or that all vineyards are necessarily doing enough at this point in time to limit those contributions. And so one thing that we'd really just like to iterate is the need for effective feedback loops and using these to inform actions, ensure that forward progress is being made, and ensure that water quality is, or ensuring that the good practices are being utilized. And there's things like increased ground cover, there's things like no-till. There's a lot of flexibility in what those measures may be, but there really needs to be some effective feedback loop to ensure that all these practices are meeting the goals and the baseline objective thresholds. And two areas that we kind of have concerns on right now are edge of field discharges. There doesn't currently, as we understand it anyway, appear to be any method of, or any requirement that there be any monitoring, and as a result, no threshold for adaptive management practices in those areas. And that not all sites are going to have that issue, but it does have a potential to be a pretty significant gap. And then the other issue that we have around the feedback loops is in regards to the exemption. The 90% ground cover incentivized practice to reduce monitoring requirements is great on its face, but there's no measurable objective to compare that to. Like, what is the goal of 90, like, what is the expected outcome of that 90%? If you have a 10% slope vineyard, if you have a 0% slope, like, there could be a lot of other site-specific differences that really impact the benefit of that incentive. And kind of getting to Noelle's point earlier was, climate also has different changes, like cover crop or ground cover may not establish. Like some years, it just may not be able to reach that 90%. And so having some sort of increased flexibility on what those measures may be is a potential option, but at the same time, there has to be some objective that they're being compared to, and then some monitoring to show that that is actually being satisfied. Not necessarily monitoring every single year, because that kind of gets away from the incentive, but like at least some baseline establishment that, hey, these measures are meeting the higher objective of what we're trying to do, and thus we're incentivizing by reducing monitoring. So those are just, oh, and one other thing. I just wanted to note that on the run-on issue, it would be a good idea to kind of think about how there could be like some sort of reporting, or not really, some sort of accounting of like who those run-on sources are, and then reporting that to regional water board staff and just kind of being like, hey, these are the measures that we took. And then having some sort of like interagency policy or something in place that helps ensure that whatever type of property that source may be is being communicated with through the applicable agency. Like I know there's been comments that Caltrans tends to be a significant run-on contributor. So maybe a vineyard contacts Caltrans, they're not doing anything. Maybe there's some other like method in place through like interagency communication where they can try and get Caltrans to go and help rectify those issues. Just trying to think of different ways to kind of help address that issue and still ensure that the sediment discharge is getting addressed. And so those are my comments, and thank you again for the opportunity to speak tonight.
Thanks, Jamie. And yeah, we just wanted to make a comment on that run-on issue. Your point is well taken. It kind of goes back to Mel's comment earlier about how to identify different run-on sources. You know, if we're going to have people out there discounting run-on sources, like you mentioned, is there a reporting mechanism by which the regional board can become more aware in general of the different, you know, potential sources out on the landscape? So we're looking into a way to accommodate that, you know, so that we can get that information. And for example, if there's a hot spot or a recurring issue with run-on, we'll have that information available to us to follow up with. Okay, so last call for folks in the Zoom room who have not yet spoken. Raise your hand and we'll see, we'll get you unmuted here. I see Gail still has her hand up. Gail, do you want to speak again, or is that a hand up from earlier? Okay, all right, I see Gail put her hand down. Okay. Any others in the room here that would like to speak? All right, I'm not seeing any. Well, I thank you all for coming out to the meeting tonight. I'll put up our contact information on the screen again before we all leave, and encourage you all to reach out to us if you have any additional thoughts or questions that you didn't get to tonight. Again, we have really appreciated working with all of you in developing these revisions. And we encourage you to go to our Vineyards page and subscribe to our listserv to kind of keep apprised of what's going on with this project. We're going to continue working with you know, the existing channels, the farm bureaus, and some of the other groups we've been working with to get the word out on when you can expect the next iteration of this order and the next meeting with our board, which would be the adoption hearing. So again, thank you for coming out. We appreciate it. And we'll be up here for a few minutes if you have any more questions or comments for us. Thank you.